Good evening and good vach. Thank you very much for coming out this evening for our Malava Malkashir, the topic being the artificial womb. I want to thank Karen and Jay Spitzer for hosting the Malava Malka this evening. It's very gracious of you to do so. I've known the Spitzers, I've known Jay for 10 years now. Jay came to the first weekly shiur that I gave in this city, the Minchas Chinuch shiur at Clinton Park on Tuesday nights. My impression of him at the time, which has continued to this day, is of a person of Torah and a person of grace and character. And Karen, I don't know as well, but I'm just kind of working.
Better.
Yeah.
I learned everything I have from him. She's telling me everything I know.
Well, thank you very much for hosting this evening. I also want to thank Pesach Goldman for, as always, his help in putting this together and inviting all of you. I also want to just take a moment. I think not everybody here is aware. I'm with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov here in the city, and Rabbi Eliyahu Avi actually lives not far from here, 120 Shelbourne. He's our Sian. Ezra Diena is right there, and he's an Avreich with us based at the Beit. He's the rabbinic assistant at the Beit. Chaya is here as well. Rabbi Alex Hecht, who's another of our Avreichim, lives in the Clinton Park area, can't be here because he had a Shabbaton this Shabbos in Hamilton. But usually we're not in Hamilton. Usually we're in Toronto. We're based at Yeshivat Or Chaim. We have a home based medrash for university students. If anybody knows any university students who are looking for a place to learn, we have programs for university students. We have adult education, special emphasis on professionals, legal professionals, medical professionals, financial services professionals, with accredited continuing education programs. Thank God we have a lot of different opportunities for the community to learn, including on Monday, Family Day. We have a Yarchei Kala that's open to men and women. It will be Monday morning. It begins with a breakfast at 9:15 and then continues with time to prepare for the shiur. The shiur itself is at 10:30. For those who are at the last Malava Malka that we did, it's sort of an extension of that. The previous Malava Malka, we discussed the sort of a new prenuptial agreement that has emerged in Israel, but it's sort of the standard model prenup. The one that we're going to discuss on Monday morning is a radical and very different prenuptial agreement called the tripartite agreement. And it is, as billed on the flyer, it's a prenup like no other. We'll be discussing it and its pros and cons, God willing, on Monday morning at Yeshivat Or Chaim. Again, breakfast is 9:15. Okay, so our topic for tonight is the artificial uterus. It doesn't actually exist yet, so therefore it may be a little redundant when I give my usual disclaimer that this is not psak. It's a fascinating topic. I was sending the Spitzers topics, potential topics for the Malava Malka. And I included this one because last year's edition of the journal Tchumen contained an article on the artificial uterus, Rechem Malachuti, as it's called in Hebrew. And I wanted to push myself to actually read the article. So the way I usually push myself to read an article is if I say I'm going to give a shiur on it, then I have to actually get around to reading it. So I put it on the list, and that was the one that they chose. And that was good until I actually read the article, because the article isn't really about the Rechem Malachuti. It's sort of a build-up to it. Basically, what the article does, it's by a fellow named Tzvi Reisman, who's a very interesting Talmid Chacham out of California, who likes to write about new technology issues. What he really did with the article was he spends most of the article, I'd say about 80%, 80 to 90% of the article, summing up positions on IVF and the question of who is the mother in a case of in vitro fertilization. Then he spends another 10% of the article giving background on the science of the artificial uterus. And then the last 10% of the article is him saying, and I think the artificial uterus is a game changer. It's going to change our understanding of how maternity works, such that those who have said that maternity is determined by gestation, by pregnancy, once they see that you can duplicate all of that with a machine, they're going to change their minds, and everybody will say, potentially, that it's the egg donor. He doesn't say that as a given. He says, this is what he thinks should perhaps happen, and he's leaving it to the postgame to decide if that's actually so, and then the article ends. So I'm left with, what do I do for sheer now? You didn't talk about the artificial uterus, and I have to do it all myself. But it's actually, it's a fascinating topic, and what I want to do is indeed to discuss the question of, is the artificial womb a game changer? Does it change the way that we look at the definition of maternity in halacha, such that the question to ask is, in the event that science proceeds, and we're going to talk about the science in a moment, but science proceeds to develop some kind of machine such that you can take an embryo, create the embryo, as is already done in a lab, put it into this machine, and then 9 months later, or maybe it doesn't need 9 months for all I know, out comes a baby. What do we say in halacha? Who is the mother, right? You think of the kids' book, Are You My Mother, right? Is the machine the mother? Is the donor of the egg the mother? How exactly does this work within halacha? That's the question that we need to ask. So, current state of things. Pregnancy tends to be, 9 months, God willing. You have the means of developing an embryo in a lab and keeping it alive for a period of days in the lab before implanting it. There's a limit currently, ethically, of 14 days. They don't allow keeping an embryo alive past that point. I brought you in source number one a piece of a paper in which they suggest that it should be expanded to a 28-day rule. And they're not talking about an embryo that's going to be implanted and then brought to life. They're talking about an embryo that is being used for research, and the question is, should it be allowed to keep it beyond the 14-day rule? But right now, for reasons that are both practical and ethical, you can only keep the embryo for 14 days. That's on the one end of pregnancy. Other end of pregnancy, through scientific advances, thank God we are now able to keep babies alive even if they're born prematurely. And my sense of the literature that I've read, and professionals can correct me if I'm wrong, my sense of the literature I've read is that you need to get to the 22, 23 week point in order to have a real chance of being able to make it because of lung development. Is that correct? Okay. The 20 to 23 weeks or so is when the odds rise dramatically to be able to save them. It's still miraculous that that's able to happen, but until then, because the lungs aren't developed, the baby's not able to survive. However, they're working on units that can help premature babies even earlier. And what you see in source number two, I apologize if the picture grosses anyone out. If you really want, those who got the email version of this, it's in color, which is even better. And if anyone didn't get the email version and wants it, you can email me afterwards. My email address is at the top of the source sheets, and I'll be glad to send it to you so you can see it. But basically what you're seeing in these pictures are lambs normally gestate for 21 weeks, and what these are basically 17-week lamb fetuses. And the first one, the one on the left, the one on your left as you look at the paper, is the 17-week, and then the one at the end, at the other side of it, is the one at 21 weeks. And what they found is that they are actually able to replicate pregnancy. Now, this wasn't the first attempt. Like, this is something that they developed over time, a lot of different attempts. There are huge ethical problems with the question of trying to develop this for human beings. But the question now is, if you were to be able to develop something like this, that could not only work for the 20-week baby, but that could work earlier and earlier and earlier, right? You can imagine a scenario in which they come up with machines like this and deploy them in hospitals and say, you know what, if Rahmana Litzlan, somebody has a pregnancy, and after 18 weeks, for whatever reason, the mother needs to give birth, try the machine. Let's say that they say such a thing. You could end up with the possibility of moving earlier and earlier within the pregnancy as these develop, to the point of having indeed what science fiction has predicted for a long time, which is the artificial uterus. That would be the idea. It would be a game changer for society, on many different levels. Meaning, if you create a machine in which the child can actually be brought to term, there are all sorts of medical questions that come up in terms of side effects, psychological side effects, mother-child bonding, and things like that. But if you think about what this means for society, it means people can have children at older ages, which raises ethical questions. Is that really an appropriate thing to do? It means that women are able to have babies and still be able to have their jobs, raise their other kids, and so on. Potentially, assuming that yeshiva tuition is ever solved, it increases the number of babies that you're able to have. There are all sorts of implications for this it really does become a game changer for society. But the question that we're going to ask tonight are not really the ethical questions. We're asking the question that I began with, which is, does this change the fact that, it's not a fact yet, but the eventual fact of you can use a machine in order to bring a child to term, does that change the way that we define maternity in halacha? Clear? Okay. I should probably take the opportunity now to note that we're going to be talking a lot about in vitro fertilization in terms of how we define maternity there, and cases of surrogacy where the egg comes from one woman but the child is gestated in a different woman. It's probably a good point to mention that the great majority of halachic authorities are opposed as a general rule to cases of surrogacy. Whether they'll ever accept it in a particular case is a good question for discussion, but in general they're not fans of the idea of one woman donating the egg and another woman carrying it to term. At the same time, they had to deal with the question of, okay, but what if somebody did it? So now, what's the rule? So, in order to do this, we first need to discuss what the range of options for maternity are. Meaning, let's go back to an IVF case, technology that we currently have and that there is actually a robust body of halachic literature on, going back, really, the major literature is the last 50 years, although you can find sparse articles that are even before that. In a case in which one woman donates the egg and the other woman is the one who carries the baby to term, what are the options in terms of who the mother is? What are the choices?
One, the other, or both?
You have four choices, right? You have four choices. It could be the egg donor. It could be the woman who carries the baby to term. It could be there's no halachic mother. Maybe you require that it be somebody who does both. Or maybe they're both the mothers. Lest you ask, what does that mean, having multiple mothers? Well, one answer would be in terms of relationships, right? The baby, God willing, comes to term, grows up, wants to get married. Who is the baby allowed to get married to? What if the egg donor is Jewish and the surrogate is not Jewish? Or vice versa? Is this child considered to be a Jewish child if you're going to tell me that there are multiple mothers? There are all sorts of questions. So saying it's the egg donor is one school of thought. We're going to come back to that. Saying it's the woman who carries the baby to term is another school of thought. We'll come back to that. But there is indeed the possibility of arguing that it is multiple mothers, that they are actually multiple. This comes up actually as a further question in the realm of what's done now, of mitochondrial DNA, a case in which you're going to use an egg from one woman but add material from another woman. Now what do you do? Now you could have three mothers in the picture. So take a look at source number three, please. From a short shuva by Rav Asher Weiss. And yes, when I heard he was going to be in town for Shabbos, someone offered to extend an invitation. I said, great, please extend the invitation, but it didn't work out for whatever reason, which is too bad because then he could have given this year. But source number three is from a tshuva of his dealing with the question of, you can see it in the link, triple parent IVF. In the interest of time, I'm reading out my English translation, but you can see the Hebrew there as well. One could conclude that the mother, from whom almost all of the genetic material comes from her flesh and bone, is the halachic mother. And the child is associated with her lineage. So in other words, what he's suggesting is the mother who provided most of the DNA, that's the one who is the mother. And even though there is room to argue that if we would compare cases, then regarding Bittul Barov, we say Davar Mamid is not Batil, and entities which affect taste are not Batil, and so one could argue here. In other words, if you were to look at it as a mixture and say, this is a mixture, just like meat and milk, you have mixtures, so to here, you have a mixture of DNA, there's a majority of DNA, there's a minority of DNA, and you can't use Bittul because there's something, you know, all of the DNA is necessary. But he says, in truth, the main force of my argument comes from what seems clear and obvious in my eyes, that it is halakhically impossible to have two mothers, just as one cannot have two fathers. If it is this one, it's not that one. He says, I'm not looking at this as a dual mother scenario, because I don't believe there is such a thing as a dual mother scenario. He says, halakha only recognizes one, and it's going to be the one who provided the majority of the material. That's the argument that he gives. Reb Ezra Bick from the Gush has written on this topic, and he agrees with that as well. But not everybody agrees. Professor Zev Lev is quoted by Rabbi J. David Bleich in number 4. For quite a few of the sources that I brought you on the sheet, I brought you the pieces as quoted by Rabbi Bleich in his writing, largely because then I could cut and paste it and didn't have to translate anything. But I checked his translations and they're good. So as you would expect. So don't worry, you're getting a legitimate thing, even if it's his summary of it. He says in number 4, a Talmudic discussion regarding a similar quandary in the area of agricultural law is cited by Professor Zev Lev in the Emek Halacha as reflecting the principle to be employed in resolving the issue of maternal identity. And he gives you the following. It is forbidden to consume newly harvested grain crops until the Omer has been offered in the temple on the second day of Passover. Right? There's a law of Chadash. The rule is that grain is aser, the new grain is prohibited until we bring the Karban Omer on the second day of Pesach. That permits all of that grain, and that becomes Yashan. That's the rule. So that offering, the Omer, renders permissible not only already harvested grain, but also grain in the field that has taken root, but which has as yet not yet fully matured. Any crop planted subsequent to the offering of the Omer does not become permissible for use as food until the following Pesach. That's the rule. So the Gemara posits a situation in which a stalk of grain is planted, has reached a stage of development equal to a third of its ultimate growth, which is a key stage for it. Having reached a stage of development, the stalk is removed from the ground before the Omer is offered, and replanted after the offering of the Omer, whereupon it continues to mature and ultimately reaches its normal stage of growth. In other words, let me sum this up outside of the text. You had grain that was growing. It reached the minimal stage of maturity such that the Omer should permit it. However, it was then taken from the ground. The Omer was brought. The grain is now mutter. Then you put the grain back in the ground, and it continues to grow. So now my question is this considered the old grain, yashan, mutter? Or do I say, no, it grew after Pesach, after the Omer, and therefore it is chadash, and needs to wait for next Pesach to be mutter? That's the question that the Gemara deals with. And the Gemara then has we have two other cases that Professor Lev brings as well. A case of Arla that's similar, a case of Kilayim that's similar, but I think this is sufficient already to sum up the question, because the analogy he's trying to draw is, in the event that one woman provides the egg, and then the embryo is implanted in somebody else, can you say providing the egg is like the first stage of growth, and then implanting it in somebody else like the second stage of growth? And, as is noted here by Rabbi Bleich, the Gemara does not resolve the question in the case of Chadash. It also discusses it in the case of Arla. It also discusses it in the case of Kilei Akerem. And the Gemara does not resolve it. The result is inconclusive, so that we are strict on both sides. And therefore, Professor Lev makes the argument that the same thing should be true regarding a case of an egg donor and a woman who carries the baby to term, to say that we should treat them both as the mother. That's the agricultural model that he brings. Rabbi Bleich himself believes that as well. he argues that you can indeed have, he has a piece on having multiple fathers. He quotes you a Tosfos in Sota, which suggests that in fact one could have multiple fathers, and the same position was taken by Rav Moshe Sternbach in the Chuvos Van Hagos, where he argued that actually the egg donor and the woman who carried the baby to term are both considered the mother. I brought it for you in source number 5, again reading my translation. In my humble opinion, one could contend that since the two women caused the formation and development of the child in the end, and one cannot have one without the other, there is room to say that both have the status of mother. The child has two mothers. Similarly, we find in Tosos and Sota that a child could have two fathers. So you have another possibility. Egg donor, gestation, both. Yes, Pesach.
How's the father's?
So the father scenario essentially is the Gemara talks about the possibility that contributions from multiple males fertilize the egg.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the Gemara's case. Yeah. They obviously they're not using modern technology to do so, and yet that comes up. Yes, Ezra.
How would Rav Asher Weiss respond to that?
So I was very surprised. Why doesn't Rav Asher Weiss, when he says explicitly you can't have it, there's no question that he's aware of the Tosfos. He must simply dismiss it. And the question then is, why is he dismissing it? And I don't know. But Sunday night, God willing, he's going to speak at the Bayit, and I'm sure we could just do a Q&A and get this question in there. It's not a bad idea. The other possibility, though, is that, in fact, we will say there is no mother. No one is considered to be the mother halachically. That since Eliezer Waldenberg makes this argument in an IVF case. Take a look at source number 6, where again Rabbi Bleich summarizes the position of the Tzitz Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, has advanced the novel view that in the eyes of halacha, a child born of in vitro fertilization has neither a father nor a mother, even if the biological mother and the gestational mother are one and the same, as is the case in the majority of instances in which in vitro procedures are employed. In other words, the egg is from the same woman who's carrying the baby to term, and yet, he says, still not the mother. Rabbi Waldenberg's arguments, which are not based upon cited precedents or analogy to other halachic provisions, are 3 in number. First, fertilization in the course of an in vitro procedure occurs in a, quote, unnatural manner through the intermediacy of a third power extraneous to the father or mother, i.e. the petri dish. The Tzitz Eliezer's position is that because this other agent helped in a necessary way, therefore no one is considered to be the mother. And in fact, in a similar position of Yehuda Gershuni in the Journal of Aram Mizrach, based on a position of Rav Malkiel Tannenbaum, the Divrei Malkiel, take this position. Right? Bleich himself is not convinced, as he continues to say, to this writer, those arguments appear to be without substance. In response to the first argument, it must be stated that the petri dish is not a third power, in no way contributes biologically or chemically to the fertilization process. It is simply a convenient receptacle designed to provide a hospitable environment in which fertilization may occur. And the other two arguments that the Tzitz Eliezer brings are, frankly, what you can dismiss his first one, you can dismiss the second and third one as well. I think his second argument is this isn't the normal way that pregnancy happens. But what does that exactly mean? How do you quantify that? Is not so clear. Alan?
I was just curious, this artificial egg thing, is that the same thing as when you hear on the news that lesbians have
piloted
eggs?
So it's not an artificial egg. It's a donated egg, right? Artificial eggs will be another shear, but the answer is yes, this could well be done. This could well be done and is done. It does happen in such circumstances. You're correct. So so now we have somebody suggesting that there's no mother. Realize the implications of saying that there's no mother, right? The obvious one is this kid Jewish? The answer, it seems, is not. The child is not Jewish. However, some of the writers on this take this much further and say the child may not be considered human. It's not just that. It's that the child may not be considered human. Because in the Gemara, when they speak about identifying the species, they don't say if it has visible characteristics of this species, that's what it is. They ask, what was it born from? The Gemara talks about cases in which a cow gives birth to something that looks like a donkey. And then the question is, how exactly do we view this? So leave aside the question of whether that ever happened in the past. It could happen now. And the question is then, if it doesn't have a halachic relationship with the woman who carried it to term and produced it, it doesn't have a halachic relationship with the donor of the egg, So what is it? Could this baby convert to Judaism? Is that even an option? So we're in very strange territory at this point. So,
okay, a solution from those areas.
So yes, I was going to mention that a little bit later, but once you throw that in, I'll mention it now. It could theoretically solve some issues of mamzerus. It could actually solve them on two levels. Meaning, there are two mamzerus concerns, right? Concern number one is there's a relationship going on that is prohibited and generates a mamzer. Concern number two is that one of the parents was a mamzer and therefore passes it along to the child. So in terms of the former, there actually is literature suggesting that in an IVF case, even if the relationship is prohibited, the child is not a mamzer, because creating a mamzer requires an act of normal reproduction. So so there actually is such an argument on the books about IVF. The second question, though, the question of passing along the traits, if the mother is the one who has mamzerus, the argument could well be made that it's not transferred because she's not the mother, if we were to really accept this view that says that there is no mother in that case. A view which becomes much stronger once you deal with what we're talking about, which is the artificial uterus discussion. So indeed, that's true. This could be this could be a practical application of it. So along comes Zvi Reisman. And by the way, I'm not speaking with disrespect when I say Tzvi as opposed to Rabbi Tzvi Reisman. He actually, as I understand it, does not have smicha and makes a point of not taking that title. So I'm not, this isn't me being insulting to him, this is actually, he doesn't have smicha. But take a look at source number 7, where I translated a piece from his essay, and again, reading my translation rather than the original. Apparently, we could conclude that since there is an artificial substitute for a woman in whose womb the fetus grows and develops, then even if in reality a child develops in a natural woman, not an artificial one, that has no effect on the laws of lineage, for one could have executed this process through artificial means as well. Right? Again, what he's saying is, since you could use a machine, therefore, pregnancy should not be determinative of the child's identity, even where it's a natural pregnancy. Once you tell me that pregnancy is not really, I shouldn't say pregnancy, that gestation in a human being is not a necessary part of the process, then maybe you should go with the egg. That's his central argument that he makes in the piece. He really likes writing about new technology and how that can be a game changer. He triggered a whole series of articles with an article of his a few years ago about artificial meat, arguing that it's not like regular meat and that it's parve and so on and so forth. Yeah, he was very energetic about that idea. And here again, he's making this push that the new technology can be a game changer. So, in terms of our discussion, what I think we need to do in order to understand this is to look at three basic halachic options from the IVF case and what theory is behind them. And then use that, extrapolate from there to say, okay, does having an artificial womb option change anything? The three options we're going to look at are, number one, the donor of the egg in an IVF case is the mother. Number two, nourishing the embryo during pregnancy, that's what makes you the mother. Or number three, birthing the baby is what makes you the mother. There actually are two other views, but I'm going with those three. Those are the dominant views that are out there. We're not seeing all the literature on this. That would take a much, much longer period of time than what we are going to use tonight. The Spitzers are not renting us the house for tomorrow. So the discussion is going to be relatively limited. But nonetheless, what I want to get across is that the view that says egg donor is the mother is for sure going to be very happy at the development of an artificial uterus and say this cements our position. However, the other two views, the view that says that the woman who carries the baby to term is the mother, or the view that says that birthing the baby makes you the mother, I don't think they're going to change their positions based on the introduction of an artificial uterus. But let's start from the beginning.
What's the difference between those second two options?
So we'll get to a Gemara Yevamos, and that will make it very clear. So it's a good question. Just I'm not ready yet. The egg donation. So quite a few poskim are quoted as holding the position that the donor of the egg is the one who is the mother, without even always presenting their opinion in any, with any explanation, but just saying this is so. So for example, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is quoted as having said that. Rav Yaakov Ariel in a journal in Tchumen, in a journal article in Tchumen, volume 15, says that he says it's Svara. He says this is just logical to me that the egg donor is the mother. But basically, the major logic to support the view that it's the egg donor is that this is the defining maternal contribution to the baby. I realize that by saying that, I may be insulting women who have carried babies to term. And I don't mean in any way to minimize what one goes through in 9 months of pregnancy. Please, don't take it that way at all. But that's this view, is to say that the donation of the genetic material is actually what does it. If you take a look at source number 8, a piece out of a Gemara in Nida, classic Gemara, Shlosha Shutfin Yeshba Adam. Right, there are three partners in creation of a human being: Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Aviv, Imo, Hashem, the father and the mother. And then it goes on to say, and the father provides this material, and that leads to that in the baby. And the mother provides this material, that leads to that in the baby. And Hashem takes care of the rest. So the Shuvas Tnei Bosem, of Meir Brandsdorfer, the Tzur Yaakov, others quote this Gemara and say, this is the contribution. Rabbi Itamar Rohaftig was the editor of Tchumen for many years, and he published a comment in Tchumen, volume 5, which had many articles on IVF, so he introduced it with his own comments. You see the Hebrew in number 9 at the bottom, and then my English translation is at the top of the next slide. And he says, it appears logical to me that a parent from whom an egg is taken is more likely to be considered the mother. The child is born from a blend of the father's seed, the mother's egg. They impact his traits. He quotes our Gemara in Nida. It appears that this is from the time of insemination, of conception. The fetal development in the womb of the mother is only the place where it grows. Today, part of this process can be done in a laboratory. Even if we will say the contribution of a mother developing it in her womb is better than that of a laboratory, still it would only be adding to the seed which has been formed in conception. As far as he is concerned, that's where the major contribution takes place. He compares it to a case in the Gemara in which somebody has an olive tree growing on their property, and then it washes downstream. There's a flood, and it washes downstream, and it lands on somebody else's property. And the primary claim to ownership of the olive tree is with the person who had it grow in his property initially, not the person in whose field it landed. There's discussion about who has the rights to the olives, if they grow more in the subsequent one, but fundamentally, the olive tree belongs to the original owner. Now, this, making the argument that identity is formed with the donation of the egg and the initial formation of the embryo, this has major ramifications for the abortion debate. Right? This has major ramifications when you deal with abortion. Rabbi Bleich makes this point in source number 10. Rabbi Bleich is of the opinion, you have to know, that basically the only abortion that will ever be mutter will be that which saves the life of the mother, including in the first 40 days. At any point, that's his position. Not every posek is on the same page, but that's his stance. So he has a stake in what he writes here in source number 10. He says, it seems to this writer, the analogy to the provisions of agricultural law fails entirely with regard to in vitro fertilization if the statement of the Gemara in Yevamos categorizing an embryo within the first 40 days of gestation as mere water is to be understood literally. Let me take a step back, actually, because I realize this needs a better preface. The Gemara in Yevamos, it's a well-known Gemara, says that an embryo in the first 40 days is maya ba'alma, is just water. The Gemara there is talking about a very specific application of that. It's not making a broad sweeping statement about the first 40 days. It's a very specific application in context in that Gemara. But some want to use that to make the argument that you can't follow the egg. Because for the first 40 days, it's just water. It's not even considered to be a full life, they say, based on that Gemara. So Rabbi Bleich makes the point here that if you're going to rely on that Gemara, then your whole olive tree discussion and all your comparisons with seeds fall apart. He says, continuing from his piece now, the end of the fourth line in source 10, it is only logical that an entity that has no identity cannot be the subject of a relationship. Or better, it stands to reason that that which is, quote, mere water knows no mother. On the other hand, if, as many authorities maintain, including Rabbi Bleich, categorization of an embryo in the early stages of development as mere water is limited in application and, for example, does not serve to prohibit destruction during that period, the analogy is quite apt. He says, if you're going to tell me that the egg determines maternity, then you can't accept the idea that it's not a life in the first 40 days. That's his point. So all of you who are on the side of the egg donor, you're with me regarding abortion. That's essentially Rabbi Bleich's position. So if you take this view that the egg donor is indeed the mother when it comes to the IVF, then the artificial uterus will be a support for your position, because now the gestation need not be done by a human being at all. Rabbi Uri Orlian has a recording in source number 11. I gave you the link, and anyone, again, who didn't get this digitally but wants it so you can click on the link instead of retyping it, I'll be glad to email it to you. But all he does in this recording is he had just come from a Q&A with Rav Asher Weiss, for rabbis, in which he had spoken about two things, artificial wombs and the artificial meat question. So he quotes what Rav Asher Weiss said about it. And what he says is that Rav Asher Weiss told them that the artificial uterus to him changes nothing. He believes that the mother is the one who provides the egg. And he says, therefore, I still believe the mother is the one who provides the egg. I should note that what I understand from Weiss is that, and what he wrote in an article in 2013, is that he isn't ready to say in an IVF case, we just go with the donor egg. He still wants, if the surrogate was not Jewish, then he still wants a conversion out of concern for the view that says that it's the gestating mother who is the mother. But that's your first view, is the view that it is the egg donor, and they are very happy to say, see that, you can have an artificial uterus, then clearly it's the egg donor who is the mother. That's your first of the three views. Are we clear on that? Yeah. Sorry?
Once you say that they should go through the conversion just for all days, and what if the person doesn't want it?
Right. So the answer is you have a problem. No, in all seriousness. Like, the parents have to understand, number one, that there's a lot of opposition in general among poskim to going through a donor egg surrogate mother scenario. But number two, they're going to have to understand that realistically, I think the vast, vast majority, and when I say vast, vast majority, I really mean 100% of those I've seen, and I'm just worried that there's somebody I haven't seen. But I think they all want conversion l'chumrah into this, and they're going to have to be willing to go through it if they want the child to be recognized. The problem is, as Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wrote, as Rav Asher Weiss wrote, as many, many writers on the topic have written, we're in such new territory with all of this. You don't have direct paradigms in the Gemara for this. We're drawing analogies from olive trees that are washed downstream, and you're going to see in a little bit the discussion about Yosef, Midrashim about Yosef and Dina being swapped in the womb. Like, if we're not grasping at straws, we're close. And so no one wants to take it on their head to say, I think this is it, to the exclusion of all the other opinions that are out there, and therefore they're all recommending that they're begir l'chumra. That's the approach that they take.
Or have Jews
handling both ends of it, correct. And then, unless you take the view that there's no mother, you know, then you're okay. Okay, the second view is the view that it is the woman who nourishes the cells into a human being in the course of pregnancy. Now, some, just like with the egg donor, some take this as a given without explanation. Rav Shaul Yisraeli has a brief paragraph on this in a tshuva in the Chabas Binyamin, Chelek Gimel. And most of his tshuva has nothing to do with this. It's the financial aspects of surrogacy. What if the surrogate carries the baby to term and decides to keep it? Do they have the right? Do they have to honor their agreement? Questions like that. And then he has this little section in which he just takes it as a given that the woman who carries the baby to term is the one who is the mother. Some do it on technical grounds, not because of a philosophy of motherhood, but simply on technical grounds. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg favors this view. He says, when you donate the egg, it is batel to the body in which it is implanted. becomes part of the body. This was not his own invention. This was written in the Chuvos Evan Yukara before him, based on a Gemara in Sotim and Gimel Amid Beis. Take a look at source number 12. Again, an agricultural analogy dealing with the laws of Arla. The laws of Arla prohibit the fruit of a tree in the first 3 years of the tree's growth. So if a young plant, young tree, is grafted to an old plant, young plant meaning under 3 years, but you then took it and you grafted it to a plant that had already been around past 3 years, and it's a mutter graft. We're not dealing with kilayim issues. It's a mutter graft. The young plant is batel to the old plant and is not subject to arla. The fruit that grows on this branch that you just grafted to the older tree is not subject to arla. It becomes part of the existing plant to which you grafted it. So you took this egg, you made an embryo, you implanted it in the mother, now it becomes part of the mother. And the Tzitz Eliezer argues, kal v'chomer. In the case of the plant, the young branch that you grafted is still there. Here, the egg came from the donor mother, but has no further relationship with her at all. There is no attachment anymore to her. And not only that, he says the egg would have gone nowhere without this mother. The mother who is now carrying this child is the one who's providing it with life. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg argues also that pregnancy is what does it. He has a fantastic piece from Rabbi Kiva Eger on a Gemara in Chulin Kuf Yud Gimel, but we're not going to go there tonight because also that would end up being the whole shir, and that would be that. But these are on technical grounds. But others make the argument that it isn't just technical analogies that lead me to say that pregnancy is what counts, but rather, it's because gestation is the mother's key contribution. Don't look at it based on the genetic material, but rather look at it based on the act of carrying the baby and developing it. Rav Moshe Sternbach takes that position in source number 13. Reading my translation, he says, logically, we could say that since the pregnancy and birth happened with the second, right, with the second woman, not with the donor, but with the woman carrying the pregnancy, the first did nothing without the subsequent implantation. It needed to be uprooted. And so definitely follow the second one. He says, she is the one who is contributing what is necessary in order for the egg to move from being an egg to being alive. The gestation wouldn't have happened without the egg either. He's okay with that. He believes the major contribution is indeed the pregnancy. Rabbi Ezra Bick from the Gush wrote a long article, which Rabbi Bleich really doesn't like. But he made the following argument. He says that you need to work with agriculture as your model because that was the way Chazal looked at pregnancy. They looked at pregnancy as the equivalent of what goes on when a seed is put in the ground and a plant emerges. Take a look at what he says in source number 14. He says, there is, however, no clear source in rabbinic literature which suggests that a woman has ova. Inasmuch as the rabbis certainly had a concept of motherhood, such a concept must be definable without reference to the ovum. This in and of itself might argue for birth as the sole determining factor for motherhood. That's the argument that he makes. He says, Chazal don't recognize eggs. Now, you'll tell me, but didn't we see the Gemara in Nida, Daf Lamed Aleph? Didn't that say explicitly that she is contributing some kind of genetic material? It said, in the word that's used is even Mazria. It sounds like it. However, he points you to the Ramban. And the Ramban on that Gemara, I didn't bring it on the sheet, suggests that it's actually not. When it talks about Mazria, what it's talking about, the shift in blood and development of the endometrial lining, which will allow for the implanting of the embryo such that it's able to take hold and develop in the uterus. That's the way that Ramban reads that Gemara. Rashi also reads that Gemara differently. It's not contribution of any sort of material. As far as they're concerned, whatever genetic would mean, go back 2,000 years, that is all in what the male contributes, and the woman's contribution is, in fact, gestation. However, he says, there is another conceptual model of parenthood, one based on the model of fertilization rather than donation and combination. This model perceives the role of father and mother as essentially parallel to what takes place in agriculture, where a seed is placed in a fertile environment. That's the way that Rabbi Bick makes the argument. So he says, in that case, what defines maternity is carrying the baby to term. That's what you should look at. You should look at the agricultural model. The woman by the name of Pamela Laufer Euclides, who wrote a fascinating essay in the Duke Journal of Gender, Law, and Policy called Gestation. You can see the title, Work for Hire or the Essence of Motherhood. I brought you a piece in number 15. It's fascinating. She says that what Rabbi Bick is doing here, and it's not just him, it's all those who take this view, what they're doing is looking at men and women differently. She says, she's dealing from a, you know, coming at this from a perspective of comparing Jewish law with secular law. See, she says, those who make the argument that you follow the egg are trying to make men and women identical. In other words, the man has a contribution to the embryo, the woman has a contribution to the embryo, and we look at them in parallel. But Judaism, she says, doesn't do that. We don't say that men and women are the same. There are differences, and one of the differences is seen here. The male is contributing this way, the woman is contributing that way. She says the majority opinion in Jewish law is that gestation is the defining characteristic of motherhood. She's probably right. Defining motherhood by that which is unique to mothers, as discussed by, she's talking about Rav Yosef Engel, who didn't discuss IVF, but he has a comment which relates to this, we'll come back to it later, and more explicitly by Rabbi Bick, is based on the Jewish law recognition of differences between men and women. So within this school of thought that says that gestation, pregnancy, is what is going to determine maternity when you're dealing with IVF, it could be based on technicalities, the analogies that we saw at other sources, the idea of bittul or something along those lines, but it could be because of a philosophy that says pregnancy is what matters. Well, if I take this view, what does the artificial uterus do? Now that you can actually duplicate pregnancy in a machine, right, not now, decades from now, but when you are able to duplicate it in a machine, does that change your perspective? What do you think? You think it should? Aitan thinks it should. Why?
Well, because now what we're saying is that it's the gestation that's following, then if this is happening outside of a human body,
yeah,
then that's what we're following, that's what we're looking at, and that creates some serious issues.
It does, but what happens next?
Well, you're in a bit of a quagmire, because you have a father, clearly, because that's solely dependent on genetic material.
Yeah, so we think.
You don't have a gestation.
So you
have a father with a mother.
Well, that's the question. See, Eitan is assuming, and I think that's what Zvi Reisman is assuming in his article, that once you devalue the contribution that is pregnancy, what that leaves you with is the egg donor. But I don't think that's necessarily the implication of their position. I think the implication of their position is that you're going to go with the no mother position. I think that's what they'll end up saying. It's lacking, right? There was no gestation. I think that's the way they're going to. I think that's the way they're going to go because they don't consider the egg a sufficient contribution to equal maternity.
But if you're following this philosophical argument through, yeah, that's a logical conclusion. You're
right.
But that's not a real scientific case.
Right. No, I mean it's a philosophy, but that's what it all is. You're right. If I were to take the Bittul argument that the egg is implanted in the mother and therefore it is buttled to her body, then I'll say then if it never got implanted in her, it's not buttled to the machine. And then I'll say you're right. Sorry.
Why not
be buttled to the machine? Because I think the Bittul, as it's seen in the sources that argue for Bittul, is more of a, it grows in this medium. Well, you say it's growing in the machine. You make the argument that the can you make the argument that this is analogous to Yalda Shestivcha B'Zekena? I don't know. Maybe. All right. It's an interesting question.
Wouldn't it depend on if the baby was ever in the mother or not? If they took the egg out,
right,
for 40 weeks it grows in a machine.
Right.
You can make the philosophical argument that there's a mother.
Right.
If they take the egg out, do IVF, put it in the mother for 20 weeks, and take it out and put it in the machine for 20 weeks, then how is it different than a premature baby that grows an incubator for 20 weeks? Then there is a mother that took it to 20-week term.
Right, so that's one of the questions that we haven't really dealt with here, which is dealt with a little bit in some of the literature, is how much pregnancy equals pregnancy. What does that mean? Do you have to bring it to the point of viability, you know, as one example? That's going to become important in a minute.
30 weeks, then 7 weeks is viable.
Right. No, but that's the question is going to be, at what point does, what do you mean when you say pregnancy is sufficient? Because you have Rosamund Nechemia Goldberg's original article on this topic in Tchumen Volume 5 was not actually dealing with IVF. It was dealing with a case in which they implanted the egg. The egg was fertilized, and then the embryo was taken out and put into somebody else. That was his original case that he was addressing. So there was pregnancy to a certain extent in a first person, although I don't think he considered that to be enough of a pregnancy, if I remember correctly. All right, you got it.
I don't understand that premise of really that comparing this to agriculture. And therefore, you could say that the gestation would constitute what the mother is. Because in agriculture, you're saying, so you plant the seed in the ground, and the fertile environment creates the growth, and that's what determines the mother. Same thing, the woman is pregnant, so she's a mother. But by agriculture, there's no seed, there's no contribution from the ground genetically. You can't say that that kind of more before all the beneficial stuff, but it's normal pregnancy conception, each parent contributed. So there's genetic growth from the mother. So you can't then overlay that cultural model and say, well, the mother's gestation is also contributing genetic seed with the egg.
Right.
So how do we understand, now that we understand things, how do we separate this premise that we're comparing pregnancy to that cultural model because it's not analogous?
Right. So you would really like Rabbi Bleich's rejoinder, Rabbi Bick, because he tears into this whole model. He says, aside from the point that you raised, he also adds that when you're dealing with agriculture, the seed deteriorates in the ground. And then you have a new plant. Here, the genetic material is what's resulting in creation of the life. How can you discount the original genetic contribution in that way? He ends up saying, his conclusion is that Rabbi Bick is asking the right question but giving the wrong answer. That was his turn of phrase. The analogy is hard to sustain on a few different levels. It's attractive because you look at it and say, oh, well, this actually, it fits to a certain extent. If they don't recognize that there are eggs, then doesn't it work? But then you start thinking about it and you say, well, not so fast. And especially when you're dealing with something which has such serious halakhic consequences, entertaining a brand new model like that is hard. Leva and then Alan. Gordon.
So I know that this would be a share for another time, but then the question is, with IVF, would the father be a question if he's a father?
Right, so yes, that's a share for another time. The question of whether he counts.
No, but is that also not a...
Right, it's also not 100%. That is correct. Alan.
And it also reflects on the world scene, like the United States, like abortion is to a fetus is born, and Canada has a different law than the United States, so it would...
Right. And the artificial uterus poses a huge challenge to abortion law. Because first of all, on a very practical level, you have the ability now for the child to be carried to term. What's the reason to abort? You have the ethical question of who makes that decision, right? I'm not as familiar with Canadian law, but in the U.S., it's basically the mother's choice. Why should it be the mother's choice? She has an equal stake at this point with the father. Why is it about her? It's not an issue of a threat to her health at all. Anymore, but most of all, people who want to make the argument that it's not alive until the end of the pregnancy, are you willing to really, or at whatever stage they're willing to do it, are you willing to say the same thing when you can see it there in the machine and it's progressing and it's no longer hidden? It becomes a very interesting question. This the impact of the artificial uterus on abortion law is going to be dramatic.
I have a hard time because, you know, you said that Chazal, they didn't really recognize the seed of the mother, and they're only talking about the womb and everything, but they didn't know about genetics then. They didn't know the importance of the seed. So it's hard to go back and take what they're saying and apply it now when they're missing so much information.
Yes and no. Yes, from a scientific perspective, it can be very hard to adopt what they're, you know, what they're saying and apply it. But at the same time, they're the ones who gave us the halachic system we have. In other words, my definition of maternity can only work with what they gave us. I'm going to go back to something I said in a shiur on Monday night. I gave a shiur on mental health and obligation in mitzvos, and began with the question that I am asked, you know, frequently within this, which is, so much of our understanding of what goes on in mental illness is modern. It's based on innovations and discussions and discoveries that you can measure in decades. So how can you apply anything in terms of the categories of illness and halachic obligations based on writings from a couple of thousand years ago? But the answer there, and I think the answer here as well, is that Chazal were less concerned with the origins of an illness than they were with its impact, that which you could perceive. So they describe somebody, example, the Mishnah in the second parak in Shabbos describes the person who needs to be off on their own in the dark, but there's a light on Shabbos. What do I do? The question is not why they need to be off and, you know, why they have this, you know, depressive episode or whatever it is that's going on. Fundamentally, they have this need, so here's what we're going to do on their behalf. The same thing is true here. Even though they may not have a conception, no pun intended, of the egg and its contribution of genetic material, they don't have to. They're perceiving that there is a life, that the mother played some role, whether that's providing the genetic material or providing the uterus, the environment in which it's going to grow, and they're saying this is the way we view that contribution, and that's what they consider significance, that which is visible to them. That's how I understand the question, but that was
so hard to think that the genetic material is not significant to the contribution of the baby that will grow up.
I hear the problem, but that's, I think that's the halachic answer. I'm actually going to proceed here just because I'm looking at the time and realizing it's getting late. So I want to make sure to get through view number three. It's not that long, and then I'm going to stick around to discuss further. So we can go round and round on that topic, I think, for a while, probably. The third view is that it's about birth, presenting the child to the world as a viable being. That's really what we are concerned with. And this position is largely on technical grounds, as opposed to philosophical grounds. It's because of specific sources. Here's one example. The Gemara in Megillah Yud-Gimel Amud Aleph, the source number 16, talking about Esther. Megillah tells us, Ki ein la av va'ein. She lacked a father and a mother, Ubumosa via ve'ima, and when her father and mother died, then Mordechai took her in, ... So the Gemara asks, Lamali, why did you need to say twice that she had no father or mother, that her father and mother had died? What are you adding? Amar Ravacha, Ibarta Mesavia. Ravacha said that upon conception her father died, and Yeladata, when she was born, Mesa Ima. Then her mother died. So Rav Yosef Engel has a comment which Rezalman Nechemya Goldberg quotes on this. Rav Yosef Engel says, Ki ein la av va'im. She had no father and mother because she didn't have a mother at birth. During pregnancy, her mother is not yet, so to speak, her mother. Why? The Maharal on Megillas Esther says that it's because we have a principle in halacha, it's debated in the Gemara, uber yerech imo. The fetus is considered to be part of the mother's body. It's not an independent entity. Only with separation from the mother at birth does it become its own entity, and that's the difference between pregnancy and birth. It's now its own thing. Rabbi Bleich notes then that this will work within the view in the Gemara that uber lav yerechimo, that it's not considered to be part of the mother, but within that school of thought, the argument goes, it's only birth that does it, because that's when the child becomes an independent being. There is a similar source which everybody mentions and nobody likes, but I feel like you can't not mention it, because it's one of those things that people learn about in grade school and then forget. The story of Yosef and Dina, right? V'achar Yolda Bas. Without going through where the Gemara sees this in the Psukim, because that's a fascinating midrashic analysis in its own right, the Gemara at the end of Brachos, towards the end of Brachos, Samach Samach Aleph, says that Leah was pregnant, and she knew, because she's Leah, that she's going to have a boy, and she says, well, if I have a boy, we already know there are going to be 12 Shvatim. How do we know that? She's Leah. There are going to be 12 Shvatim. If I have this child, that means that I'm going to have 7 out of the Shvatim, the Shpachos, Bilhah and Zilpah, already have two each. That means Rachel isn't even going to be the equal of Bilhah and Zilpah. That's terrible. And so she davens that it should instead be a girl, that it should be Dina. The classic version of this in the Gemara is that she davens and the child is actually transformed. It was going to be a male, and it becomes a female. However, Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, which was not actually Yonasan ben Uziel, because as the Gemara tells us, he only wrote on Navi. Nonetheless, the Targum that is printed as the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel says what I brought you in number 17. The Aramaic is at the bottom of one side, English top of the next side. And God heard the prayers of Leah, and the fetuses were switched in their wombs. And Yosef was placed into the womb of Rachel, and Dinah into the womb of Leah. So, what that means is, even though we always say Yosef is the son of Rachel, the truth is that he was born from Rachel. But Leah carried him at some point. And again, at what point in the pregnancy is this? I don't know. But the idea then would be that this demonstrates that birth is sufficient. Nobody likes this proof.
Could be majority of
could be, right. We don't know at what stage in the pregnancy and whether it was later in the correct. It's also agadata. Not to mention, we have a separate problem with this whole thing, which is there's a medrash, once you're already talking medrashim, there's a medrash that says that Dina marries Shimon. How can Dina marry Shimon? Are they not brother and sister? Right? Brother and sister from the same father and from the same mother. So the Medrash says, no, it's not. It's the Tur commenting who says this. He says that that it's not, because Dina is actually considered the daughter of Rachel. Well, that just throws everything out the window now. Now, if you're going to use a Medrash, now what do you do with this Medrash? There are loads of answers to this, but it's the sort of thing that has no practical ramifications, because no one's willing to paskin from this. But one answer, the Tzitz Eliezer says, maybe when Hashem moves Dina into Leah from Rachel, moves Yosef from Leah into moves Dina from Rachel into Leah, then everything goes. In other words, all the genetic material associated with the original donor of the egg is removed from them, and it is switched, because if Hashem can already move them from one to one, so what's the big deal? You know, change some genes also. Whatever that even means. The Tzur Yaakov says that it was actually not that at all. He says it's a swap of the neshamos. The bodies stay. The neshamos are switched. Okay. That leads to a whole other fascinating discussion, which is there such a thing as a male or female neshama? But that's way beyond what we're doing tonight. But didn't.
Leah perceived she had male shaman in her body.
Yes, correct. Okay. Yes. Don't ask any more questions, please. If you take a look at source number 18, you get one last Gemara that gets quoted for this. This Gemara is taken much more seriously on this topic than the Esther one and the Dina Yosef one. This one is one that gets a lot of discussion. Shnei Achim Ta'omim Gerim, twin brothers convert. So we're now talking about twin brothers who actually just, they're brothers. They're alive, they're walking around, they're doing stuff, and then they convert to Judaism. So the rule is they're not considered to be brothers halachically. Gershon is Geir, Katan Shinola Dami. When somebody converts to Judaism, all their relationships are severed and start again. But the second half of this source, what if they're in utero? They were conceived, and their mother wasn't Jewish. Then the mother converted to Judaism, went to mikvah, while pregnant. They're born once their mother is already a Jew. So the rule is, they don't perform chalitza or yibum for each other. On the one hand, we would not have them do chalitza, we would not require chalitza, we wouldn't have them do yibum. However, one would be liable for relations with his brother's wife. We consider them to be related as far as the isurim, as far as the prohibitions that would come with siblinghood. So the argument goes, and again, we don't know when within the pregnancy she did this conversion. Was it 3 months in? Was it 6 months in? We don't know. But what we're saying is, the fact that they were carried by her when she wasn't Jewish doesn't matter, because they're born from her as a Jew, and therefore they're considered to be related to each other. Now, there's a lot of debate on this. The Chuvas Ran Hagos has a whole other way to read this Gemara, and to try to apply it. But this is brought to show that birth creates relationships. Rabbi Bleich argues that that's actually what we say practically. If you take a look at source number 19, he says, although there is a minority view that regards the donor mother as the sole mother of a child born of in vitro fertilization, the consensus of rabbinic opinion is that a maternal filial relationship is generated between the gestational mother and the child, despite the absence of any genetic relationship, by virtue of parturition alone. He doesn't go with pregnancy. He's saying birth. Whether or not the genetic mother, i.e. the woman who produced the ovum from which the child was conceived, is also a mother from the vantage point of Jewish law, will you say there are multiple mothers, is a more complex question. The question of whether the baby may in fact have two halachic mothers must be regarded as yet open. But he believes that birth is indeed what does it, and maybe even two mothers could actually be a valid result. So what's the philosophy here? They don't state a philosophy. It appears to be technical sources. But I think the philosophy driving it is the way I introduced it in the first place, which is the child is part of the body of the mother, like the Maharal said on that Gemara, and maternity refers to the woman who first turns the baby into an independent creature. Maybe a professor in graduate school. I don't know. But independent in the sense that it no longer needs to live inside its mother. That's what I mean.
Those are two different things.
Yes. So now, ask the question again. Introducing an artificial uterus, does that change the equation? I don't think it does. I don't think it's going to make them say that the egg donor is the one that matters, because their point remains. They don't consider the egg enough of a contribution to equal maternity. It's making the child into a viable life that actually is what they view as maternity and producing it. It isn't even gestation. They're taking the view that it's parturition, that it's birth, that's actually doing it. You know, again, in practice, when this comes up, everybody seems to say they want the child to be converted when we're dealing with IVF. But applying it to the artificial uterus, the argument in favor of the egg donor is going to be reinforced by the introduction of an artificial uterus. And they're going to continue to promote that view. But I think the argument in favor of pregnancy, or the argument in favor of birth, I don't think that they're going to revert to the egg donor. I think they're much more likely to go with the no mother view, at least l'chumra. Once again, I want to thank the Spitzers for hosting. I'm going to take discussion and questions and all that afterwards, but there's a lot of food still there. Please do take some of the food off of their hands. We have the Yarchei Kala coming up on Monday morning at Or Chaim. 9:15 is breakfast, or you can just come for the shiur at 10:30, and that's on the tripartite agreement. Lots of other shiur. For those of you who are not on our email list, I will be glad to add you to our email list. Just let me know. Thank you very much. Goodbye.